Hello, I'm Molly Wansell.
And I'm Geoffrey Wansell.
And for the last 16 years or thereabouts, we've been having lunch every Saturday. And often our conversation turns to murder.
Which is why we decided to launch a podcast about murder called Blood Ties.
Hi everyone, welcome back to the Blood Ties podcast. I'm Molly Wansell and I'm here with my father, Geoffrey Wansell.
Hello everyone, welcome back. Thank you again for listening. It's a privilege to be able to talk to you about such terrible things. But it's amazing how many people are interested. And I remain utterly fascinated, captivated by this extraordinary subject. Murder is a universal. Everyone has an interest in it. I can't exactly explain why, but my goodness me, they do.
No, one of the new girls at work said that when I said we had a podcast. She was like, I love true crime. Everyone loves true crime.
I was saying before we started, it's often ladies that stop me in the street.
That might be because you're so handsome, Dad.
I don't think so. Well, 73-year-old man, you are pulling my leg. But and they say, oh, I've seen you on television. And I say, oh, yes. She said, I'm fascinated by true crime and I love murder. And this happened to me in the buffet at Exeter St David's Railway Station this week.
The fans can be everywhere.
It's amazing.
The fans are everywhere.
I'm going to do this live one this coming week.
Oh, yeah. Your live show is on a Tuesday.
Yes.
I put the link on our Instagram so people could buy tickets.
Crikey.
I wonder. Last time I checked, they would sold 180.
180?
I think so, yeah.
My goodness me.
I know, so.
I'm doing...
maybe it's sold out.
Oh, let's hope so. I'm doing a show with David Suchet tomorrow at Wilton's, in favour of Wilton's Music Hall, raise money for a new sound system.
Mm.
And they sold that out, 350.
Immediately. David's a big pull. Yeah. It's not just David, though.
It's David and me.
It's just you and David.
Yeah, that's all. Somebody's seen this, because we did this on a tour, you may
remember.
And somebody saw the tour and offered him 10 weeks in Australia if we both went.
Oh, yeah, you told me that. Just to contextualise this, listeners, Geoffrey wrote a book with David Suchet about Poirot.
Crime again,
this time fictional. And they did, when they sort of did a book tour and did a sort of Q&A in theatres around the UK. It was very jolly. I came to the one at BFI.
Yes, the most beautiful...
Oh, that's when they aired the last ever Poirot with David in it.
That's right. The most beautiful one. We did Nottingham, which is the Frank Matcham Theatre, which is absolutely spectacular. But you've been to New York this week.
I have been to New York this
week. What did you see?
I went to see my client Kay Van Novak in a TV version of a film called What We Do in the Shadows, which is coming out on FX next week on Wednesday. It's about vampires living in the modern day. In a house share.
Oh, lovely.
It's really funny. It's really funny.
Well, is it meant to be funny?
Yes.
That's something. Yes.
Yeah. Well, that's good. Yeah, they'd hit that on the head. But yeah, it's a long way to go to watch a telly program.
It is a bit. It's quite funny that when David first went to the Belgrade Theatre in Coventry and met his wife-to-be, Sheila Ferris, she then was, they were doing a show called Dracula.
Well, there you go.
It's amazing how...
Talking of music halls, I went to Alexandra Palace to the newly refurbished... They're calling it a theatre. It's not really a theatre. It's more like another concert space. It would be good for talks and stuff like that.
That's
good. It's very beautiful.
How big?
It's massive. It felt massive.
What, are we talking about 1,000?
No. I don't know how big it is. More than 300... I think.
Goodness. Yeah. Well, I did hear one really good story yesterday. How many seats does the White Rock Auditorium at Hastings have?
I don't know what the White Rock Auditorium is.
It's basically a theatre.
Oh, I don't know.
Guess.
600?
1066. It's Hastings.
Is that true?
It is.
Oh, my word. That's quite funny. That's all I've been up to, flying across the other side of the
world. As ever, I've been reviewing, and I reviewed a really good, I think an excellent
book. That's what we talked about last week, book.
Mm, it's so good, though.
Have you finished? You mean you just love it
I've reviewed
more?
It.
Oh, you've actually done the review of it now.
It appeared yesterday.
He's talking about the devil aspect, which is the book we reviewed, you will have heard last time, and we did that little video about. Do you remember?
Indeed.
I put that on our Instagram also.
Indeed. It is very good, and it's a wonderful depiction of the nature of evil and whether the devil can actually exist in human form.
I think that would depend on whether you believe in the devil.
Well, it's a very persuasive argument, and it also is, it references back to Jack the Ripper, because the fictional character called the Leather Apron is killing women in Prague, and in an uncannily similar manner to the Jack the Ripper killings in Victorian London. And interestingly enough, the character we're talking about today is very, very similar.
Okay. Well, let's start. Who are we doing? I literally have no idea because I haven't even been in the country. What are we doing today?
We're doing a man called Robert Napper.
Are we going to give him a name?
And he was known as the Green Chain Rapist.
So here we go with the Green Chain Rapist.
Robert Napper, Robert Clive Napper, to give him his full name, was born in southeast London, in Plumstead, the son of a driving instructor called Brian and a mother called Pauline. He had two brothers and one sister. He was born in 1966, in February, just before England won the World Cup the last time. Brought up in Plumstead, he was a troubled child, to put it politely, and indeed it was a very abusive marriage. Father beat mother, father beat the children, and mother took this extraordinary step of taking her son, Robert, to the Maudsley to be examined by a psychiatrist when he was literally 6 or 7 years old.
Why?
Well, he exhibited what you could describe as antisocial tendencies. Now, we don't have any record of whether or not he harmed animals or set fires, the classic examples of serial killers. But we do know that at one point before the marriage broke up, when he would have been about 8, he came back to his father one day and said, he said to him, "The psychiatrist thinks I'm mad, Dad." And the father said, "I thought he was just mucking about like children do. But later I found out that what he'd said was true." And this is a boy not quite 9. His parents divorce when he's 9. And for a time, he and the brothers and the sister are farmed out to foster homes. They reunite with the mother, Pauline. But the next significant moment in Napper's career or his development is that when he's on a camping family holiday, he's abused by a family friend, and the family friend is jailed for the crime. It was said by his mother that from that moment on, Napper descended into isolation, he became reclusive, and he also became a not unfamiliar characteristic among some serial killers. He became obsessively tidy.
How old was he when that camping trip happened?
12 or 13.
Oh, right, sorry.
He was very unpopular at school. He had terrible acne. He's very white-faced. And the boys at school, he went to Abbey Wood Comprehensive, despised him. In fact, no one wanted to sit next to him, one boy said later. He didn't have any friends and was teased a lot about his spots. And in a game of football once, when he headed the ball, the game stopped because no other boy would go near the ball after he touched it with his forehead.
That's really sad.
Well, one would feel sadder for Napper had he not been or become a truly violent.
He wasn't necessarily a truly violent boy then.
Well, I think there are indications that he may have hurt people when he was in his, what you might describe as his adolescence. He grew to be remarkably tall, 6'2".
That's tall.
Very white-faced, very introverted. didn't have many qualifications. He got a variety of job, manual jobs, warehouseman, worked for the Ministry of Defence. That was a clerk. But what is absolutely abundantly clear is that he, A, became a voyeur, particularly of his sister, whom he would always try and see undressing. He bullied his brothers and developed a habit, one might almost call it an obsession, with young mothers and their children.
That's quite weird.
Well, I think it's, I think there's a bit about what happened to him when his father was still in the marriage. I think that he saw his father essentially abuse his mother when he and his brothers and sister were very small. I think there's an element in there somewhere. But what is undeniable is that he developed an absolute disregard for the validity of human life, and particularly the right of a woman to have any kind of life. He was to become one of the most relentless rapists in modern times.
So grim.
And all in a relatively short period between about 1989 and 1994. It's impossible to be absolutely certain what set Napper off, but it's pretty clear that he first came into contact with the police at the age of 19 when he was carried a loaded air gun in the street. He had a habit of leaving guns of various kinds in tin boxes, some of which he buried. But he was found in the street and he was charged. In fact, he was given a conditional discharge and asked to pay £10 in costs. And this was in August 1986. Napper, for one reason or another, developed an obsession, a literal obsession, with young mothers with small children. It's pretty clear that in August 1989, he would be 23, he broke into a house in Wynn's Common, which backs on to Plumstead Common. It's all part of a great walkway.
It's like very suburban around there.
It's pretty suburban, yeah. A lot of young mothers pushing buggies.
Mm-hmm.
Big open space.
Mm-hmm.
There's a house on the edge of Wynn's Common. He breaks into the house through the back door, clearly having watched the house for some time. That's one of the habits he had. He was a stalker as well as a voyeur. He's watched the house for some time, and the mother, in this case, had left the back door open so the cat could get in. That's how Napper got in. The children were downstairs, and he was wearing a balaclava and carrying a knife. He ordered the woman onto the bed where he raped her. Knives were to become another part of the Napper armory. The tragedy is that although Napper left DNA evidence, the semen, there was no link to Napper.
He wasn't on file anywhere.
Wasn't on any file anywhere. But 3 months later, his mother, Pauline, called the police and told them that her son had confessed to her a rape on Plumstead Common. Well, in fact, the attack was not on Plumstead Common, but in a house nearby, and no link nor record was made. The first of many opportunities missed Robert Napper. This simply went on. In March 1992, he attacks a 17-year-old girl in Hither Green, walking to visit a friend on the Cordwell estate. Again, he has a knife. If you want to live, don't make any noise. More violent this time. Punched her in the face. Threatened her again with a knife. Fondled her. But, as was to be the case on many occasions with Napper, didn't manage penetration. I think it would be fair to say that the knife that he used so frequently was his penis substitute.
He had some issues.
He had considerable issues. He could ejaculate, but not penetrate. In March 1992, he attacks another, this time in Eltham Palace Road, where he's on the way to King's John's Walk, which is part of the Green Chain Walk, which is how he got the nickname, the Green Chain Rapist.
Oh, okay, because he's going around.
He's going around
like
a very specific area.
Okay.
Now, how often have we talked about that? You know, you can nail down.
He feels really like the Golden State Rapist, East Coast Rapist.
Yes.
Like similar MO,
Golden State Killer.
Similar vibe, like
absolutely
similar style.
Very much involved with knives, very much young women, focusing on particular kinds of...
And did they not do that, what's the word for it, with the, when you do the profiling based on the location?
Geographical.
Yeah, they didn't do that.
They didn't. Well, it was a long time ago, darling.
Yeah.
I mean, 92, we didn't have the DNA technique. We didn't have geographical profiling, which is now a commonplace on Criminal Minds.
Yeah,
you know, everybody's
yeah.
doing geographical
exactly.
locating. But until David Cantor really did it here with Mulcahy, the railway rapists in London,
yeah.
it wasn't done. It simply was not done.
Mm.
Okay, another girl is there. This time he uses the knife in a more caressing kind of a way. He points it at her breasts and
really creeping me out.
Well, he was a creepy man. In May 92, he ties a rope ligature around the neck of a 22-year-old woman as she pushes her 2-year-old daughter in a buggy along King John's Walk. He repeatedly beats her, strips her and rapes her. She begs for her life until eventually he jumped up, pulled what remains of his clothes up and ran off. Ironically, a neighbour at that occasion alerted detectives to the EFIT. They by now had come up because the number of attacks of the killer, the rapist, they're calling the Green Chain Rapist. And one of the neighbours, one of Napper's neighbours, says to the police, he looks awfully like Robert Napper. And Napper is invited to, come into the police station. He doesn't go.
And they don't go and get him?
No. And repeatedly doesn't go. And repeatedly doesn't give a DNA sample.
Obviously.
But then, in July, on the 15th of July 1992, he commits probably one of the most famous murders in contemporary history. A young woman named Rachel Nickell, 23, is walking across Wimbledon Common in broad daylight with her son, a young son, Alex, who's 2, and her dog, a Labrador, called Molly.
Most popular female pet name, or it was, for a long time.
Suddenly, a man appears from nowhere. Alex, the little boy, later described him as loping, strange, black, blank face, a black bag, a white shirt. He throws Alex to the ground and assaults Rachel. Not just assaults Rachel, he stabs her 49 times.
Oh my goodness.
49 times.
That's so violent.
And it is such a violent crime. Remember, we're talking about Wimbledon Common. The tennis has only just finished. It's a July day in broad daylight. A young mother and her tiny son
and dog
and a dog are walking across an extraordinarily open part of Wimbledon Common. Napper is so controlled, he kills her, adjusts his clothing again, walks to a nearby stream where he washes his hands. Alex is still watching this man and walks, doesn't run, walks away. The little boy sits down beside his mother and tries to persuade her to wake up.
Oh,
he
no.
says, "Wake up, mummy, get up." Unfortunately,
so
Rachel Nickell is dead. To be honest, Alex is lucky to have escaped with his life, as we will see. But now this was
that
one of the
terrified London.
One of the most public murders of the 90s. In the same way as Amélie Delagrange on Twickenham Green was one of the most public murders of the noughties,
yeah.
which Levi Belfield killed her. Napper, not a sign of him, disappears back to the manual labour. The Metropolitan Police, as even they, I think, would admit now, make an absolute botch.
Well, I mean, they've already made a botch because they could have worked out who he was ages ago.
For a variety of reasons, including the use of a particular profiler, they decide that it's a local unemployed man called Colin Stagg who has killed Rachel Nickell. And they launch something very rare, a honey trap. They get an undercover female police officer, known colloquially as Lizzie Jones, to make a relationship with Stagg so that he'll confess to her his fantasies.
That doesn't seem like good policing to me.
Well, when it got to the Old Bailey, the judge threw it out.
Yeah, unsurprisingly. What a load of nonsense.
Without question, threw it out. But what it meant was that the investigation became focused on and taking no interest in anybody but Colin Stagg, who they thought was absolutely right for it.
Napa must have just been like, "Well, this is easy."
I can't imagine. I mean, when finally Stagg is charged and taken to trial in 1994, the judge says, "Deceptive conduct of the grossest kind," and the police are described as using excessive zeal in convicting Stagg, or attempting to convict Stagg. The case is thrown out. Eventually, Stagg is awarded £706,000 in compensation.
Yeah, not enough. That is terrible. Poor man.
But what it did was it focused attention on someone other than
Napa.
Okay. We're in April 1993. Remember, the attack is in July 92. In December 1992, Napa is arrested for possession of a firearm and ammunition. Again, his fascination with arms of one kind or another. And he's actually given 2 months in jail. But significantly, he's also fingerprinted.
And they take his DNA.
Okay.
Hooray.
But still, he comes out of jail. And I don't take this lightheartedly. You can't. But on the 3rd of November 1993, he commits the second foul murder. He's been watching a young woman called Samantha Bissett, a former model, not unlike Rachel, actually, both very pretty. She lives in a flat in Plumstead. He watches her for several days. He clearly sees her making love with her boyfriend. He decides, we don't know exactly what the order was, he decides to burst into the back door, the same as the very early attack in 1989, burst through the back door and attacks her with a knife, stabs her 8 times. The one so severe, it fractures her spinal cord.
Oh my God.
She dies in the hallway. But to add insult and gross depravity to this despicable crime, he goes upstairs to where her daughter Jasmine is in her room. He proceeds to suffocate her after sexually assaulting the 4-year-old.
That's so awful.
And covers her with a duvet, which is used to suffocate her. But it doesn't even end there. And why I believe Napa is one of the truly depraved people that we've dealt with. He goes back downstairs, drags the inert body of Samantha Bissett into the sitting room, where he proceeds to relentlessly mutilate her.
Oh, no.
I won't go into all the details.
No, thank
but
you.
Effectively, the word evisceration is the correct one.
That is awful.
And to add, if it's possible, insult to injury, he takes away a part of her abdomen as a trophy.
He's really spiralling.
He is. But he arranges the body on a cushion and covers it, the cushion where he's watched she and her boyfriend make love, and displaying a mutilated genitals. I mean, this is a man.
This guy is really messed up.
He's seriously out of control. He covered her body in a robe, and it wasn't until the following morning, when her boyfriend returned, that the murder was discovered. An experienced female police photographer was among the first to attend the scene, and she was so traumatized by what she saw and photographed that she never worked again. I mean, this was a dramatic, dramatic killing, and the evidence must have been, I can only think of a couple of others, the family that the man fled to Thailand and he beat them over the head with a baseball bat.
Oh, yeah, yeah, we did.
I mean,
yeah.
they were lying there for a month and they'd virtually turned to sludge.
Yeah.
And the police, the Manchester police, said many of the people first on the scene simply couldn't work again. It was just so traumatic. Nevertheless, Napa is still...
Free.
And indeed, it didn't go all that quickly. Napa is not rapidly arrested. But gradually, it's one of those extraordinary things about this crime. I can't even quite understand why Samantha Bissett's fingerprints and Napa's were incredibly close in description. And they take, obviously, the scenes of crime officers lift the prints, and they lift a Napa print, but they think it's Samantha's. Then in the blood they find a very distinctive baseball
shoe print,
of which there were very few. It's quite a new baseball shoe,
mm-hmm.
or a basketball shoe, and gradually begin to put together. They have now a beginnings of an idea that perhaps that fingerprints and Napa's match, and that the baseball, he's bought a pair of baseball boots recently, mm-hmm. and they're not on wide supply, and they have the fingerprint from his previous conviction, remember?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Okay, so in May they launch a surveillance to establish that Napa is indeed the person that they think he is. Napa is unaware that he's being watched. And in May 1994, he's finally arrested and charged with the Bissett murders. Daughter, and a further DNA sample is taken. That DNA sample, that subsequent one, identifies him as a man who's conducted 106 sexual assaults, including 70 rapes, in a period of between 1989 and his arrest in 1994.
70 rapes?
70. He was probably the most prolific rapist that London has seen for 50 years.
Awful.
He was and is a truly awful man. In fact, I don't think there's any way you can call him anything except truly evil. Napa is charged in Belmarsh, where he's sent on remand, with two of the rapes and two attempted rapes based on the DNA sample.
Not the murders.
He's charged with the murders.
Oh, right.
He's charged with the two Bissett murders,
two rapes
and two attempted rapes. In fact, when he comes to trial, one of the rapes is dropped and he's tried for the two murders and two attempted rapes and one rape. Initially, he denies it. But, and I think this is, again, further evidence of his extraordinary character, Napa starts to boast in Belmarsh that he's always wanted to go to Broadmoor. And he's clearly mad. The other prisoners think this is ridiculous, but nevertheless, Napa insists, no, I am mad. I'm going to go to Broadmoor. After all, I can play Scrabble there and it'll be a very nice life. And, I know it sounds bizarre, but he actually did. And when he finally gets...
Maybe he just wanted to be caught all this time.
Oh, I wonder. When he finally comes to the trial at the Old Bailey in October 1995, he admits the murders and the rapes. And his defence? Diminished responsibility due to...
Insanity. What a surprise.
And guess where he gets sent to?
Broadmoor.
Precisely.
Well, yeah.
Now, we still have Rachel Nichols' murder on file. Stagg, by this point, has been acquitted and the charge thrown out.
And given 700 and something.
There then begins a series of cold case investigations of Nichols. And more and more DNA work is carried out. Until finally, a different private company in 2004 has taken a different kind of DNA sample from a taping. We've talked about taping of the skin before, haven't we?
Yeah, we have.
And the DNA profile on that taping is matched to the more recent DNA profile of Napa. In June 2006, the police visit Napa in Broadmoor. He's interviewed under caution for 5 days, but absolutely denies it. Point blank, nothing to do. I wasn't in Wimbledon Common. Unfortunately, I think there was still a belief that possibly it wasn't Napa. Anyway, whatever happens... A further investigation goes into the contamination of the DNA. And finally, on the 4th of December 2007, 15 years after Rachel's killing, Napa is charged. And on the 18th of December 2008, 16 years after Rachel lost her life on Wimbledon Common that morning, Napa pleads guilty. But only to manslaughter, because, of course...
He was insane.
...of diminished responsibility.
I mean, he's staying in prison for the rest of his life, so why...
Absolutely. Well, he was given a whole life term, of course, for the Nichols killing.
Mm.
And there can be no doubt at all that Napa will never see the light of freedom again, just as Brady didn't. Just as Peter Sutcliffe, who is also in Broadmoor, never will, the Yorkshire Ripper. Napa deserves to be in that company because, in my mind, he is every bit as depraved as either Brady or Sutcliffe. This is a persistent, relentless rapist who has no respect for human life, no respect for women, and indeed is prepared to kill a four-year-old girl. It is unspeakable. By a strange irony, my old friend Bill Clegg, who defended Colin Stagg and got him off, also defended Robert Napa in 1995.
No way.
But what is so chilling about Napa is, and I think, is his... He was a sexual sadist. He had no sense of intimacy. He had a lack of a sense of self, no question of that, and a lack of understanding of others. But he also was a fantasist. At one point or another, he talked about, that he'd won the Nobel Peace Prize, that he'd fought in Angola, that he had millions in the bank in southeast London, and that an IRA bomb had blown his fingers off, but they'd grown back miraculously. I mean, it sounds bizarre.
He was in, yeah.
Anyway, but what is undeniable and what I think is so chilling is that he got incredible gratification from the suffering of his victims. He wanted to watch them suffer.
Yeah.
And he wanted to... I think he ended up stabbing Samantha after the 8 times in the hallway. I think he stabbed her a further 67 times in the living room of her flat.
It's just awful.
There is very, very little by way of exculpation for Napper. He doesn't deserve it. And he is, quite rightly, incarcerated for the rest of his life. But when you compare him, for example, to the more famous cases, whether it's Ian Brady or Sutcliffe, or Napper's name wouldn't come up.
No, that's so. I didn't know about him at all.
On your radar.
But that's very prolific, as you said, in terms of what he...
Absolutely.
The crimes he committed.
But all I would say, and I can only... I'm so grateful that Napper is indeed incarcerated, is that had he not been, I can only guess at how many other crimes he would have committed.
A lot.
And how many other women might have lost their lives.
Yeah.
So let's return to a more cheerful subject.
Yeah, well, thanks very much, Dad. There's Robert Napper, the Green Chain Killer. Rapist, sorry. Yeah. Green Chain Rapist. Thank you. That was horrible.
I'm afraid it is a very, very, very nasty case.
Yeah,
and
forgive
me. We don't do them all like that. But
no.
There is something about Napper which is unforgettable.
Mm.
This 6'2" man who, for a long time, in the rape... investigation, he was dismissed because every description had the rapist as being shorter. But the funny thing about Napper was that he used to stoop a lot. And Alex, Rachel Nickell's son, who is still with us living with his father in Spain, and the Met have denied them any compensation.
What he said, that he was shorter because he was.
Yes.
He's the one who said he was lolloping.
Yes, the little boy said he was shorter than you expect.
Yeah. Oh well, thank you very much.
Not sure you need to thank me on that one, really.
Well, you know what I mean.
I do.
Appreciate the effort you put into telling us that.
Yeah.
You've got your big talk coming up this week.
Yes, I'm. My first time with a live audience, which will be very interesting.
Oh, it's going to be great.
I'm fascinated to know.
Well, you're mainly fascinated by why people are buying tickets to hear you talk about serial killers.
Yes. I'm talking about Ted Bundy, Frederick West and Levi Belfield.
Yeah.
And
Ted Bundy's very popular now since his Netflix doc.
Yes. I've watched that all episodes 3 times.
3 times?
Yes.
Was that enough? Perhaps once more.
I might have one more look. But I'm particularly going to do the... because he was such an extraordinary character, Bundy. Charismatic.
That's because he was so charming that people are so interested in him.
A law graduate.
Handsome.
A psychology graduate.
Yeah.
Worked for the Republicans. And what's more, escaped from jail not once but twice.
Mm.
And was only finally caught in an ordinary traffic stop.
Oh, yes.
It's just the way Frederick West was finally caught. It wasn't by... you know, Sherlock Holmes and brilliant police work.
Yeah,
it was by something as simple and straightforward as an ordinary policeman thinking that the Volkswagen Beetle that Bundy was driving looked a bit odd.
Yeah.
And indeed it was.
Oh, well, I'm sure your talk's going to be good.
I should be fascinated.
We'll find out.
Well,
I'm looking forward to hearing
I'm supposed to be going
to
do another one in Manchester, aren't I?
Yeah. Then they're going to make you go to Manchester and do it up there so the people of the north can hear you talk about serial killers too.
Well, when I did Murder by the Sea, the first two... series. We did a lot in that area, and I went up to Manchester to.
You did all your promo up there, didn't you?
Yes, and I
was on billboards and
I was
stuff
on bus
up there.
Sides. Yes, very exciting.
They put you on bus stops in London.
Yeah, and what I liked too was that when you went to the post office to get your benefits, you know, they have those things that change all the time when you're in the queue.
Yeah.
Well, I kept appearing. So
you're
when you got into the collect your benefits
ads,
or
you
send your parcel, there I was.
Oh,
you know.
Then they would hopefully watch your show.
Well, I think quite a lot of them did.
Oh, good. Well, that's excellent. I'm going to the theatre a lot again.
Okay, what are you going to see?
I'm going to an educational Romeo and Juliet at the Globe. I represent Romeo.
Good.
And I'm going back to see Richard III at Alexandra Palace.
Okay.
So,
I don't think I'm doing... What else am I doing?
Oh, dear. Probably a whole plethora of things.
I am. I'm doing more death. I'm doing...
you're doing
third series of Murder by the Sea voiceovers.
Yeah, you are.
I've just done two more World's Most Evil Killers.
Busy with death.
One can't take it lightly, but there are moments when you think, this is very strange.
You think how this has happened to you.
Yes, I mean, it is very odd.
Yeah, true.
Since that day I first encountered Frederick West, or rather Rosemary West in the flesh and Frederick West in his clothes, back in 1995.
Well, there we go. Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure, darling. Thank you very much.